Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe. Narrated by Peter Francis James. This work is copyrighted 1959 by Chinua Achebe. This recording is copyrighted 1997 by Recorded Books.
Part 1. Chapter 1. Okonkwo was well known throughout the nine villages, and even beyond. His fame rested on solid personal achievements. As a young man of 18, he had brought honor to his village by throwing Amalinze, the cat. Amalinze was the great wrestler who for 7 years was unbeaten from Umuofia to Mbaino. He was called the cat because his back would never touch the earth. It was this man that Okonkwo threw in a fight which the old men agreed was one of the fiercest since the founder of their town engaged a spirit of the wild for 7 days and 7 nights. The drums beat and the flutes sang and the spectators held their breath. Amalinze was a wily craftsman, but Okonkwo was as slippery as a fish in water. Every nerve and every muscle stood out on their arms, on their backs and their thighs, and one almost heard them stretching to breaking point. In the end, Okonkwo threw the cat. That was many years ago, 20 years or more, and during this time, Okonkwo's fame had grown like a bushfire in the Harmattan. He was tall and huge, and his bushy eyebrows and wide nose gave him a very severe look. He breathed heavily, and it was said that when he slept, his wives and children in their houses could hear him breathe. When he walked, his heels hardly touched the ground, and he seemed to walk on springs, as if he was going to pounce on somebody. And he did pounce on people quite often. He had a slight stammer, and whenever he was angry and could not get his words out quickly enough, he would use his fists. He had no patience with unsuccessful men. He had had no patience with his father. Unoka, for that was his father's name, had died 10 years ago. In his day, he was lazy and improvident, and was quite incapable of thinking about tomorrow. If any money came his way, and it seldom did, he immediately bought gourds of palm wine, called round his neighbors, and made merry. He always said that whenever he saw a dead man's mouth, he saw the folly of not eating what one had in one's lifetime. Unoko was, of course, a debtor, and he owed every neighbor some money, from a few cowries to quite substantial amounts. He was tall, but very thin, and had a slight stoop. He wore a haggard and mournful look, except when he was drinking or playing on his flute. He was very good on his flute, and his happiest moments were the 2 or 3 moons after the harvest, when the village musicians brought down their instruments hung above the fireplace. Unoka would play with them, his face beaming with blessedness and peace. Sometimes another village would ask Unoka's band and their dancing Egwugu to come and stay with them and teach them their tunes. They would go to such hosts for as long as 3 or 4 markets, making music and feasting. Unoka loved the good fare and the good fellowship, and he loved this season of the year, when the rains had stopped and the sun rose every morning with dazzling beauty. And it was not too hot either, because the cold and dry Harmattan wind was blowing down from the north. Some years, the Harmattan was very severe, and a dense haze hung on the atmosphere. Old men and children would then sit round log fires, warming their bodies. Unoka loved it all, and he loved the first kites that returned with the dry season, and the children who sang songs of welcome to them. He would remember his own childhood, how he had often wandered around looking for a kite sailing leisurely against the blue sky. As soon as he found one, he would sing with his whole being, welcoming it back from its long, long journey, and asking it if it had brought home any lengths of cloth. That was years ago, when he was young. Unoka, the grown-up, was a failure. He was poor, and his wife and children had barely enough to eat. People laughed at him because he was a loafer, and they swore never to lend him any more money because he never paid back. But Unoka was such a man that he always succeeded in borrowing more and piling up his debts. One day, a neighbor called Okoye came in to see him. He was reclining on a mud bed in his hut, playing on the flute. He immediately rose and shook hands with Okoye, who then unrolled the goatskin which he carried under his arm and sat down. Unoka went into an inner room and soon returned with a small wooden disc containing a kola nut, some alligator pepper, and a lump of white chalk. "I have kola," he announced when he sat down, and passed the disc over to his guest. "Thank you. He who brings kola brings life. But I think you ought to break it," replied Okoye, passing back the disc. "No, it is for you, I think." And they argued like this for a few moments, before Unoka accepted the honor of breaking the kola. Okoye, meanwhile, took the lump of chalk, drew some lines on the floor, and then painted his big toe. As he broke the kola, Unoka prayed to their ancestors for life and health and for protection against their enemies. When they had eaten, they talked about many things, about the heavy rains which were drowning the yams, about the next ancestral feast, and about the impending war with the village of Mbino. Unoka was never happy when it came to wars. He was, in fact, a coward, and could not bear the sight of blood. And so he changed the subject and talked about music, and his face beamed. He could hear in his mind's ear the blood-stirring and intricate rhythms of the Ekwe and the Udu and the Ogene, and he could hear his own flute weaving in and out of them, decorating them with a colorful and plaintive tune. The total effect was gay and brisk. But if one picked out the flute as it went up and down and then broke up into short snatches, one saw that there was sorrow and grief there. Okoye was also a musician. He played on the ogene. But he was not a failure like Unoka. He had a large barn full of yams, and he had three wives. And now he was going to take the Idimili title, the third highest in the land. It was a very expensive ceremony, and he was gathering all his resources together. That was, in fact, the reason why he had come to see Unoka. He cleared his throat and began. "Thank you for the kola. You may have heard of the title I intend to take shortly." Having spoken plainly so far, Okoye said the next half a dozen sentences in Proverbs. Among the Igbo, the art of conversation is regarded very highly, and proverbs are the palm oil with which words are eaten. Okoye was a great talker, and he spoke for a long time, skirting round the subject and then hitting it finally. In short, he was asking Unoka to return the 200 cowries he had borrowed from him more than 2 years before. As soon as Unoka understood what his friend was driving at, he burst out laughing. He laughed loud and long, and his voice rang out, clear as the ogene, and tears stood in his eyes. His visitor was amazed and sat speechless. At the end, Unoka was able to give an answer between fresh outbursts of mirth. "Look at that wall," he said, pointing at the far wall of his hut, which was rubbed with red earth so that it shone. "Look at those lines of chalk." And Okoye saw groups of short, perpendicular lines drawn in chalk. There were 5 groups, and the smallest group had 10 lines. Unoka had a sense of the dramatic, and so he allowed a pause, in which he took a pinch of snuff and sneezed noisily, and then he continued. "Each group there represents a debt to someone, and each stroke is 100 cowries. You see, I owe that man 1,000 cowries, but he has not come to wake me up in the morning for it. I shall pay you, but not today. Our elders say that the sun will shine on those who stand before it shines on those who kneel under them. I shall pay my big debts first." And he took another pinch of snuff, as if that was paying the big debts first. Okoye rolled his goatskin and departed. When Unoka died, he had taken no title at all, and he was heavily in debt. Any wonder, then, that his son, Okonkwo, was ashamed of him. Fortunately, among these people, a man was judged according to his worth, and not according to the worth of his father. Okonkwo was clearly cut out for great things. He was still young, but he had won fame as the greatest wrestler in the 9 villages. He was a wealthy farmer, and had 2 barns full of yams, and had just married his 3rd wife. To crown it all, he had taken 2 titles and had shown incredible prowess in 2 intertribal wars. And so although Okonkwo was still young, he was already one of the greatest men of his time. Age was respected among his people, but achievement was revered. As the elders said, if a child washed his hands, he could eat with kings. Okonkwo had clearly washed his hands, and so he ate with kings and elders. And that was how he came to look after the doomed lad, who was sacrificed to the village of Umofia by their neighbors to avoid war and bloodshed. The ill-fated lad was called Ikemefuna. Chapter 2. Okonkwo had just blown out the palm oil lamp and stretched himself on his bamboo bed when he heard the ogene of the town crier piercing the still night air. "Gome, gome, gome, gome," boomed the hollow metal. Then the crier gave his message, and at the end of it, beat his instrument again. And this was the message. Every man of Umofia was asked to gather at the marketplace tomorrow morning. Okonkwo wondered what was amiss, for he knew certainly that something was amiss. He had discerned a clear overtone of tragedy in the crier's voice, and even now he could still hear it as it grew dimmer and dimmer in the distance. The night was very quiet. It was always quiet except on moonlight nights. Darkness held a vague terror for these people, even the bravest among them. Children were warned not to whistle at night, for fear of evil spirits. Dangerous animals became even more sinister and uncanny in the dark. A snake was never called by its name at night, because it would hear. It was called a string. And so, on this particular night, as the crier's voice was gradually swallowed up in the distance, silence returned to the world. A vibrant silence, made more intense by the universal trill of 1,000,000,000 forest insects. On a moonlight night, it would be different. The happy voices of children playing in open fields would then be heard. And perhaps those not so young would be playing in pairs in less open places. And old men and women would remember their youth. As the Igbo say, when the moon is shining, the cripple becomes hungry for a walk. But this particular night was dark and silent. And in all the nine villages of Mwofia, a town crier with his ogene asked every man to be present tomorrow morning. Okonkwo, on his bamboo bed, tried to figure out the nature of the emergency. War with a neighboring clan? That seemed the most likely reason, and he was not afraid of war. He was a man of action, a man of war. Unlike his father, he could stand the look of blood. In Umwofia's latest war, he was the first to bring home a human head. That was his fifth head, and he was not an old man yet. On great occasions, such as the funeral of a village celebrity, he drank his palm wine from his first human head. In the morning, the marketplace was full. There must have been about 10,000 men there, all talking in low voices. At last, Ogbwefi Ezeugo stood up in the midst of them and bellowed four times, Umwofia Kwenu! And on each occasion he faced a different direction and seemed to push the air with a clenched fist. And 10,000 men answered, Ya! Each time. Then there was perfect silence. Ogbwefi Ezeugo was a powerful orator and was always chosen to speak on such occasions. He moved his hand over his white head and stroked his white beard. He then adjusted his cloth, which was passed under his right armpit and tied above his left shoulder. Mwofia Kwenu, he bellowed a fifth time, and the crowd yelled in answer. And then suddenly, like one possessed, he shot out his left hand and pointed in the direction of Mbaino, and said through gleaming white teeth, firmly clenched, Those sons of wild animals have dared to murder a daughter of Umwofia. He threw his head down and gnashed his teeth and allowed a murmur of suppressed anger to sweep the crowd. When he began again, the anger on his face was gone, and in its place, a sort of smile hovered, more terrible and more sinister than the anger. And in a clear, unemotional voice, he told Mwofia how their daughter had gone to market and Mbaino and had been killed. That woman, said Ezeugo, was the wife of Ogbwefi Udo, and he pointed to a man who sat near him with a bowed head. The crowd then shouted with anger and thirst for blood. Many others spoke, and at the end it was decided to follow the normal course of action. An ultimatum was immediately dispatched to Mbaino, asking them to choose between war on the one hand and on the other the offer of a young man and a virgin as compensation. Mwofia was feared by all its neighbors. It was powerful in war and in magic, and its priests and medicine men were feared in all the surrounding country. Its most potent war medicine was as old as the clan itself. Nobody knew how old. But on one point there was general agreement. The active principle in that medicine had been an old woman with one leg. In fact, the medicine itself was called Agadunwai, or old woman. It had its shrine in the center of Umwofia, in a cleared spot. And if anybody was so foolhardy as to pass by the shrine after dusk, he was sure to see the old woman hopping about. And so the neighboring clans, who naturally knew of these things, feared Umwofia, and would not go to war against it without first trying a peaceful settlement. And in fairness to Umwofia, It should be recorded that it never went to war, unless its case was clear and just, and was accepted as such by its oracle, the oracle of the hills and the caves. And there were indeed occasions when the oracle had forbidden Umwolfia to wage a war. If the clan had disobeyed the oracle, they would surely have been beaten, because their dreaded Agadi Nwai would never fight what the Igbo call a fight of blame. But the war that now threatened was a just war. Even the enemy clan knew that. And so when Okonkwo of Umwolfia arrived at Umbino as the proud and imperious emissary of war, he was treated with great honor and respect. And 2 days later, he returned home with a lad of 15 and a young virgin. The lad's name was Ikemefuna, whose sad story is still told in Umwolfia unto this day. The elders, or Indiche, met to hear a report of Okonkwo's mission. At the end, they decided, as everybody knew they would, that the girl should go to Ogbwefi Udo to replace his murdered wife. As for the boy, he belonged to the clan as a whole, and there was no hurry to decide his fate. Okonkwo was, therefore, asked on behalf of the clan to look after him in the interim. And so, for 3 years, Ikemefuna lived in Okonkwo's household. Okonkwo ruled his household with a heavy hand. His wives, especially the youngest, lived in perpetual fear of his fiery temper, and so did his little children. Perhaps down in his heart, Okonkwo was not a cruel man. But his whole life was dominated by fear, the fear of failure and of weakness. It was deeper and more intimate than the fear of evil and capricious gods and of magic, the fear of the forest and of the forces of nature, malevolent, red in tooth and claw. Okonkwo's fear was greater than these. It was not external, but lay deep within himself. It was the fear of himself, lest he should be found to resemble his father. Even as a little boy, he had resented his father's failure and weakness. And even now, he still remembered how he had suffered when a playmate had told him that his father was Ogbala. That was how Okonkwo first came to know that Ogbala was not only another name for a woman, it could also mean a man who had taken no title. And so Okonkwo was ruled by one passion: to hate everything that his father, Unoka, had loved. One of those things was gentleness, and another was idleness. During the planting season, Okonkwo worked daily on his farms from cockcrow until the chickens went to roost. He was a very strong man and rarely felt fatigue, but his wives and young children were not as strong, and so they suffered. But they dared not complain openly. Okonkwo's first son, Nwoye, was then 12 years old, but was already causing his father great anxiety for his incipient laziness. At any rate, that was how it looked to his father, and he sought to correct him by constant nagging and beating. And so, Nwoye was developing into a sad-faced youth. Okonkwo's prosperity was visible in his household. He had a large compound, enclosed by a thick wall of red earth. His own hut, or obi, stood immediately behind the only gate in the red walls. Each of his three wives had her own hut, which together formed a half moon behind the obi. The barn was built against one end of the red walls, and long stacks of yam stood out prosperously in it. At the opposite end of the compound was a shed for the goats, and each wife built a small attachment to her hut for the hens. Near the barn was a small house, the medicine house, or shrine, where Okonkwo kept the wooden symbols of his personal god and of his ancestral spirits. He worshipped them with sacrifices of kolanut, food, and palm wine, and offered prayers to them on behalf of himself, his three wives, and eight children. So, when the daughter of Umwofia was killed in Umbaino, Ikemefuna came into Okonkwo's household. When Okonkwo brought him home that day, he called his most senior wife and handed him over to her. "He belongs to the clan," he told her, "so look after him." "Is he staying long with us?" she asked. "Do what you're told, woman," Okonkwo thundered and stammered. "When did you become one of the Ndichie of Mwofia?" And so Nwoye's mother took Ikemefuna to her hut and asked no more questions. As for the boy himself, he was terribly afraid. He could not understand what was happening to him or what he had done. How could he know that his father had taken a hand in killing a daughter of Umwofia? All he knew was that a few men had arrived at their house, conversing with his father in low tones, and at the end he had been taken out and handed over to a stranger. His mother had wept bitterly, but he had been too surprised to weep. And so the stranger had brought him and a girl a long, long way from home, through lonely forest paths. He did not know who the girl was, and he never saw her again. Chapter 3. Okonkwo did not have the start in life which many young men usually had. He did not inherit a barn from his father. There was no barn to inherit. The story was told in Umwofia of how his father, Unoka, had gone to consult the oracle of the hills and the caves to find out why he always had a miserable harvest. The oracle was called Ogbala, and people came from far and near to consult it. They came when misfortune dogged their steps, or when they had a dispute with their neighbors. They came to discover what the future held for them, or to consult the spirits of their departed fathers. The way into the shrine was a round hole at the side of a hill, just a little bigger than the round opening into a hen house. Worshippers, and those who came to seek knowledge from the god, crawled on their belly through the hole and found themselves in a dark, endless space in the presence of Ogbala. No one had ever beheld Ogbala, except his priestess. But no one who had ever crawled into his awful shrine had come out without the fear of his power. His priestess stood by the sacred fire which she built in the heart of the cave and proclaimed the will of the god. The fire did not burn with a flame. The glowing logs only served to light up vaguely the dark figure of the priestess. Sometimes, a man came to consult the spirit of his dead father or relative. It was said that when such a spirit appeared, the man saw it vaguely in the darkness, but never heard its voice. Some people even said that they had heard the spirits flying and flapping their wings against the roof of the cave. Many years ago, when Okonkwo was still a boy, his father, Unoka, had gone to consult Ogbala. The priestess in those days was a woman called Chika. She was full of the power of her god, and she was greatly feared. Unoka stood before her and began his story. "Every year," he said sadly, "before I put any crop in the earth, I sacrifice a cock to Ani, the owner of all land. It is the law of our fathers. I also kill a cock at the shrine of Ifejoku, the god of yams. I clear the bush and set fire to it when it is dry. I sow the yams when the first rain has fallen and stake them when the young tendrils appear. I weed Hold your peace! Screamed the priestess, her voice terrible as it echoed through the dark void. You have offended neither the gods nor your fathers. And when a man is at peace with his gods and his ancestors, his harvest will be good or bad, according to the strength of his arm. You, Unoka, are known in all the clan for the weakness of your machete and your hoe. When your neighbors go out with their axe to cut down virgin forests, you sow your yams on exhausted farms that take no labor to clear. They cross 7 rivers to make their farms. You stay at home and offer sacrifices to a reluctant soil. Go home and work like a man. Unoka was an ill-fated man. He had a bad chi, or personal god, and evil fortune followed him to the grave, or rather, to his death, for he had no grave. He died of the swelling, which was an abomination to the earth goddess. When a man was afflicted with swelling in the stomach and the limbs, he was not allowed to die in the house. He was carried to the evil forest and left there to die. There was the story of a very stubborn man who staggered back to his house and had to be carried again to the forest and tied to a tree. The sickness was an abomination to the earth, and so the victim could not be buried in her bowels. He died and rotted away above the earth, and was not given the first or the second burial. Such was Unoka's fate. When they carried him away, he took with him his flute. With a father like Unoka, Okonkwo did not have the start in life which many young men had. He neither inherited a barn nor a title, nor even a young wife. But in spite of these disadvantages, he had begun even in his father's lifetime to lay the foundations of a prosperous future. It was slow and painful, but he threw himself into it like one possessed, and indeed, he was possessed by the fear of his father's contemptible life and shameful death. There was a wealthy man in Okonkwo's village who had 3 huge barns, 9 wives, and 30 children. His name was Nwakibie, and he had taken the highest but one title which a man could take in the clan. It was for this man that Okonkwo worked to earn his first seed yams. He took a pot of palm wine and a cock to Nwakibie. 2 elderly neighbors were sent for, and Nwakibie's 2 grown-up sons were also present in his obi. He presented a kola nut and an alligator pepper, which were passed round for all to see and then returned to him. He broke the nut, saying, We shall all live. We pray for life, children, a good harvest, and happiness. You will have what is good for you, and I will have what is good for me. Let the kite perch, and let the eagle perch too. If one says no to the other, let his wing break. After the kola nut had been eaten, Okonkwo brought his palm wine from the corner of the hut where it had been placed, and stood it in the center of the group. He addressed Nwakibie, calling him Our Father. Na ai, he said. I have brought you this little kola. As our people say, a man who pays respect to the great paves the way for his own greatness. I have come to pay you my respects, and also to ask a favor. But let us drink the wine first. Everybody thanked Okonkwo, and the neighbors brought out their drinking horns from the goatskin bags they carried. Nwakibie brought down his own horn, which was fastened to the rafters. The younger of his sons, who was also the youngest man in the group, moved to the center, raised the pot on his left knee, and began to pour out the wine. The first cup went to Okonkwo, who must taste his wine before anyone else. Then the group drank, beginning with the eldest man. When everyone had drunk two or three horns, Nwakibie sent for his wives. Some of them were not at home, and only four came in. "Is Anasi not in?" he asked them. They said she was coming. Anasi was the first wife, and the others could not drink before her, and so they stood, waiting. Anasi was a middle-aged woman, tall and strongly built. There was authority in her bearing, and she looked every inch the ruler of the women folk in a large and prosperous family. She wore the anklet of her husband's titles, which the first wife alone could wear. She walked up to her husband and accepted the horn from him. She then went down on one knee, drank a little, and handed back the horn. She rose, called him by his name, and went back to her hut. The other wives drank in the same way, in their proper order, and went away. The men then continued their drinking and talking. Ogbwefe Idigo was talking about the palm wine tapper, Obiako, who suddenly gave up his trade.
"There must be something behind it," he said, wiping the foam of wine from his mustache with the back of his left hand. "There must be a reason for it. A toad does not run in the daytime for nothing."
"Some people say the oracle warned him that he would fall off a palm tree and kill himself," said Akukalya. "Obiako has always been a strange one," said Nwakibie. "I've heard that many years ago, when his father had not been dead very long, he had gone to consult the oracle. The oracle said to him, 'Your dead father wants you to sacrifice a goat to him.' Do you know what he told the oracle? He said, 'Ask my dead father if he ever had a fowl when he was alive.' Everybody laughed heartily, except Okonkwo, who laughed uneasily, because, as the saying goes, an old woman is always uneasy when dry bones are mentioned in a proverb. Okonkwo remembered his own father. At last, the young man who was pouring out the wine held up half a horn of the thick white dregs and said, 'What we are eating is finished.' 'We have seen it,' the others replied. 'Who will drink the dregs?' he asked.
'Whoever has a job in hand,' said Idigo, looking at Nwakibie's elder son, Igwelo, with a malicious twinkle in his eye. Everybody agreed that Igwelo should drink the dregs. He accepted the half-full horn from his brother and drank it. As Idigo had said, Igwelo had a job in hand because he had married his first wife a month or two before. The thick dregs of palm wine were supposed to be good for men who were going in to their wives. After the wine had been drunk, Okonkwo laid his difficulties before Nwakibie. 'I have come to you for help,' he said. 'Perhaps you can already guess what it is. I have cleared a farm, but have no yams to sow. I know what it is to ask a man to trust another with his yams, especially these days when young men are afraid of hard work. I am not afraid of work. The lizard that jumped from the high Iroko tree to the ground said he would praise himself if no one else did. I began to fend for myself at an age when most people still suck at their mother's breasts. If you give me some yam seeds, I shall not fail you.'" Nwakibie cleared his throat. "It pleases me to see a young man like you these days, when our youth has gone so soft. Many young men have come to me to ask for yams, but I have refused, because I knew they would just dump them in the earth and leave them to be choked by weeds. When I say no to them, they think I am hard-hearted, but it is not so. Eneke, the bird, says that since men have learned to shoot without missing, he has learned to fly without perching. I have learned to be stingy with my yams, but I can trust you. I know it as I look at you. As our fathers said, you can tell a ripe corn by its look. I shall give you 200 yams. Go ahead and prepare your farm. Okonkwo thanked him again and again and went home feeling happy. He knew that Nwakibie would not refuse him, but he had not expected he would be so generous. He had not hoped to get more than 400 seeds, but would now have to make a bigger farm. He hoped to get another 400 yams from one of his father's friends at Isuzo. Sharecropping was a very slow way of building up a barn of one's own. After all the toil, one only got a third of the harvest. But for a young man whose father had no yams, there was no other way. And what made it worse, in Okonkwo's case, was that he had to support his mother and 2 sisters from his meager harvest. And supporting his mother also meant supporting his father. She could not be expected to cook and eat while her husband starved. And so, at a very early age, when he was striving desperately to build a barn through sharecropping, Okonkwo was also fending for his father's house. It was like pouring grains of corn into a bag full of holes. His mother and sisters worked hard enough, but they grew women's crops, like cocoa yams, beans, and cassava. Yam, the king of crops, was a man's crop. The year that Okonkwo took 800 seed yams from Nwakibie was the worst year in living memory. Nothing happened at its proper time. It was either too early or too late. It seemed as if the world had gone mad. The first rains were late, and when they came, lasted only a brief moment. The blazing sun returned, more fierce than it had ever been known, and scorched all the green that had appeared with the rains. The earth burned like hot coals and roasted all the yams that had been sown. Like all good farmers, Okonkwo had begun to sow with the first rains. He had sown 400 seeds when the rains dried up and the heat returned. He watched the sky all day for signs of rain clouds and lay awake all night. In the morning, he went back to his farm and saw the withering tendrils. He had tried to protect them from the smoldering earth by making rings of thick sisal leaves around them. But by the end of the day, the sisal rings were burned dry and gray. He changed them every day and prayed that the rain might fall in the night. But the drought continued for 8 market weeks, and the yams were killed. Some farmers had not planted their yams yet. They were the lazy, easy-going ones who always put off clearing their farms as long as they could. This year, they were the wise ones. They sympathized with their neighbors with much shaking of the head, but inwardly, they were happy for what they took to be their own foresight. Okonkwo planted what was left of his seed yams when the rains finally returned. He had one consolation. The yams he had sown before the drought were his own, the harvest of the previous year. He still had the 800 from Nwakibie and the 400 from his father's friend, so he would make a fresh start. But the year had gone mad. Rain fell as it had never fallen before. For days and nights together, it poured down in violent torrents and washed away the yam heaps. Trees were uprooted, and deep gorges appeared everywhere. Then the rain became less violent, but it went from day to day without a pause. The spell of sunshine, which always came in the middle of the wet season, did not appear. The yams put on luxuriant green leaves, but every farmer knew that without sunshine, the tubers would not grow. That year, the harvest was sad, like a funeral, and many farmers wept as they dug up the miserable and rotting yams. One man tied his cloth to a tree branch and hanged himself. Okonkwo remembered that tragic year with a cold shiver throughout the rest of his life. It always surprised him, when he thought of it later, that he did not sink under the load of despair. He knew that he was a fierce fighter, but that year had been enough to break the heart of a lion. "Since I survived that year," he always said, "I shall survive anything." He put it down to his inflexible will. His father, Unoka, who was then an ailing man, had said to him during that terrible harvest month, "Do not despair. I know you will not despair. You have a manly and a proud heart. A proud heart can survive a general failure, because such a failure does not prick its pride. It is more difficult and more bitter when a man fails alone." Unoka was like that in his last days. His love of talk had grown with age and sickness. It tried Okonkwo's patience beyond words. Chapter 4. "Looking at a king's mouth," said an old man, "one would think he never sucked at his mother's breast." He was talking about Okonkwo, who had risen so suddenly from great poverty and misfortune to be one of the lords of the clan. The old man bore no ill will towards Okonkwo. Indeed, he respected him for his industry and success. But he was struck, as most people were, by Okonkwo's brusqueness in dealing with less successful men. Only a week ago, a man had contradicted him at a kindred meeting, which they held to discuss the next ancestral feast. Without looking at the man, Okonkwo had said, "This meeting is for men." The man who had contradicted him had no titles. That was why he had called him a woman. Okonkwo knew how to kill a man's spirit. Everybody at the kindred meeting took sides with Osugo when Okonkwo called him a woman. The oldest man present said sternly that those whose palm kernels were cracked for them by a benevolent spirit should not forget to be humble. Okonkwo said he was sorry for what he had said, and the meeting continued. But it was really not true that Okonkwo's palm kernels had been cracked for him by a benevolent spirit. He had cracked them himself. Anyone who knew his grim struggle against poverty and misfortune could not say he had been lucky. If ever a man deserved his success, that man was Okonkwo. At an early age, he had achieved fame as the greatest wrestler in all the land. That was not luck. At the most, one could say that his chi, or personal god, was good. But the Igbo people have a proverb that when a man says yes, his chi says yes also. Okonkwo said yes very strongly, so his chi agreed. And not only his chi, but his clan too, because it judged a man by the work of his hands. That was why Okonkwo had been chosen by the 9 villages to carry a message of war to their enemies, unless they agreed to give up a young man and a virgin to atone for the murder of Udo's wife. And such was the deep fear that their enemies had for Umofia, that they treated Okonkwo like a king and brought him a virgin who was given to Udo as wife and the lad, Ikemefuna. The elders of the clan had decided that Ikemefuna should be in Okonkwo's care for a while. But no one thought it would be as long as 3 years. They seemed to forget all about him as soon as they had taken the decision. At first, Ikemefuna was very much afraid. Once or twice he had tried to run away, but he did not know where to begin. He thought of his mother and his 3-year-old sister and wept bitterly. Nwoye's mother was very kind to him and treated him as one of her own children. But all he said was, "When shall I go home?" When Okonkwo heard that he would not eat any food, he came into the hut with a big stick in his hand and stood over him while he swallowed his yams, trembling. A few moments later, he went behind the hut and began to vomit painfully. Nwoye's mother went to him and placed her hands on his chest and on his back. He was ill for 3 market weeks, and when he recovered, he seemed to have overcome his great fear and sadness. He was by nature a very lively boy, and he gradually became popular in Okonkwo's household, especially with the children. Okonkwo's son, Nwoye, who was 2 years younger, became quite inseparable from him, because he seemed to know everything. He could fashion out flutes from bamboo stems, and even from the elephant grass. He knew the names of all the birds, and could set clever traps for the little bush rodents. And he knew which trees made the strongest bows. Even Okonkwo himself became very fond of the boy. Inwardly, of course. Okonkwo never showed any emotion openly, unless it be the emotion of anger. To show affection was a sign of weakness. The only thing worth demonstrating was strength. He therefore treated Ikemefuna as he treated everybody else, with a heavy hand. But there was no doubt that he liked the boy. Sometimes, when he went to big village meetings or communal ancestral feasts, he allowed Ikemefuna to accompany him, like a son, carrying his stool and his goatskin bag. And indeed, Ikemefuna called him father. Ikemefuna came to Umofia at the end of the carefree season between harvest and planting. In fact, he recovered from his illness only a few days before the week of peace began. And that was also the year Okonkwo broke the peace and was punished, as was the custom, by Izeani, the priest of the earth goddess. Okonkwo was provoked to justifiable anger by his youngest wife, who went to plait her hair at her friend's house and did not return early enough to cook the afternoon meal. Okonkwo did not know at first that she was not at home. After waiting in vain for her dish, he went to her hut to see what she was doing. There was nobody in the hut, and the fireplace was cold. "Where is Ojiugo?" he asked his second wife, who came out of her hut to draw water from a gigantic pot in the shade of a small tree in the middle of the compound. "She has gone to plait her hair." Okonkwo bit his lips as anger welled up within him. "Where are her children? Did she take them?" he asked with unusual coolness and restraint. "They are here," answered his first wife, Nwoye's mother. Okonkwo bent down and looked into her hut. Ojiugo's children were eating with the children of his first wife. "Did she ask you to feed them before she went?" "Yes," lied Nwoye's mother, trying to minimize Ojiugo's thoughtlessness. Okonkwo knew she was not speaking the truth. He walked back to his obi to await Ojiugo's return. And when she returned, he beat her
very heavily. In his anger, he had forgotten that it was the week of peace. His first two wives ran out in great alarm, pleading with him that it was the sacred week. But Okonkwo was not the man to stop beating somebody halfway through, not even for fear of a goddess. Okonkwo's neighbors heard his wife crying and sent their voices over the compound walls to ask what was the matter. Some of them came over to see for themselves. It was unheard of to beat somebody during the sacred week. Before it was dusk, Azeani, who was the priest of the earth goddess, Ani, called on Okonkwo in his obi. Okonkwo brought out kola nut and placed it before the priest. Take away your kola nut. I shall not eat in the house of a man who has no respect for our gods and ancestors. Okonkwo tried to explain to him what his wife had done, but Azeani seemed to pay no attention. He held a short staff in his hand, which he brought down on the floor to emphasize his points. Listen to me, he said when Okonkwo had spoken. You are not a stranger in Umuofia. You know as well as I do that our forefathers ordained that before we plant any crops in the earth, we should observe a week in which a man does not say a harsh word to his neighbor. We live in peace with our fellows to honor our great goddess of the earth, without whose blessing our crops will not grow. You have committed a great evil. He brought down his staff heavily on the floor. Your wife was at fault, but even if you came into your obi and found her lover on top of her, you would still have committed a great evil to beat her. His staff came down again. The evil you have done can ruin the whole clan. The earth goddess, whom you have insulted, may refuse to give us her increase, and we shall all perish. His tone now changed from anger to command. You will bring to the shrine of Ani tomorrow one she-goat, one hen, a length of cloth, and 100 cowries. He rose and left the hut. Okonkwo did as the priest said. He also took with him a pot of palm wine. Inwardly, he was repentant, but he was not the man to go about telling his neighbors that he was in error. And so people said he had no respect for the gods of the clan. His enemies said his good fortune had gone to his head. They called him the little bird, Nza, who so far forgot himself after a heavy meal that he challenged his chi. No work was done during the week of peace. People called on their neighbors and drank palm wine. This year they talked of nothing else but the Inso Ani, which Okonkwo had committed. It was the first time for many years that a man had broken the sacred peace. Even the oldest men could only remember one or two other occasions somewhere in the dim past. Ogbwefi Ezeudu, who was the oldest man in the village, was telling two other men who came to visit him that the punishment for breaking the peace of Ani had become very mild in their clan. It has not always been so, he said. My father told me that he had been told that in the past, a man who broke the peace was dragged on the ground through the village until he died. But after a while, this custom was stopped, because it spoiled the peace which it was meant to preserve. Somebody told me yesterday, said one of the younger men, that in some clans it is an abomination for a man to die during the week of peace. It is indeed true, said Ogbwefe Ezeudu. They have that custom in Obodoani.
If a man dies at this time, he is not buried, but cast into the evil forest. It is a bad custom which these people observe, because they lack understanding. They throw away large numbers of men and women without burial. And what is the result? Their clan is full of the evil spirits of these unburied dead, hungry to do harm to the living.
After the week of peace, every man and his family began to clear the bush to make new farms. The cut bush was left to dry, and fire was then set to it. As the smoke rose into the sky, kites appeared from different directions and hovered over the burning field in silent valediction. The rainy season was approaching when they would go away until the dry season returned. Okonkwo spent the next few days preparing his seed yams. He looked at each yam carefully to see whether it was good for sowing. Sometimes he decided that a yam was too big to be sown as one seed, and he split it deftly along its length with his sharp knife. His eldest son, Nwoye, and Ikemefuna helped him by fetching the yams in long baskets from the barn and in counting the prepared seeds in groups of 400. Sometimes Okonkwo gave them a few yams each to prepare, but he always found fault with their effort, and he said so with much threatening. "Do you think you are cutting up yams for cooking?" he asked Nwoye. "If you split another yam of this size, I shall break your jaw. You think you are still a child? I began to own a farm at your age. And you," he said to Ikemefuna, "do you not grow yams where you come from?" Inwardly, Okonkwo knew that the boys were still too young to understand fully the difficult art of preparing seed yams, but he thought that one could not begin too early. Yam stood for manliness, and he who could feed his family on yams from one harvest to another was a very great man indeed. Okonkwo wanted his son to be a great farmer and a great man. He would stamp out the disquieting signs of laziness which he thought he already saw in him. "I will not have a son who cannot hold up his head in the gathering of the clan. I would sooner strangle him with my own hands. And if you stand staring at me like that," he swore, "a Madiora will break your head for you." Some days later, when the land had been moistened by two or three heavy rains, Okonkwo and his family went to the farm with baskets of seed yams, their hoes and machetes, and the planting began. They made single mounds of earth in straight lines all over the field and sowed the yams in them. Yam, the king of crops, was a very exacting king. For three or four moons it demanded hard work and constant attention from cockcrow till the chickens went back to roost. The young tendrils were protected from the earth heat with rings of sisal leaves. As the rains became heavier, the women planted maize, melons, and beans between the yam mounds. The yams were then staked, first with little sticks, and later with tall and big tree branches. The women weeded the farm three times at definite periods in the life of the yams, neither early nor late. And now, the rains had really come, so heavy and persistent that even the village rainmaker no longer claimed to be able to intervene. He could not stop the rain now, just as he would not attempt to start it in the heart of the dry season without serious danger to his own health. The personal dynamism required to counter the forces of these extremes of weather would be far too great for the human frame. And so nature was not interfered with in the middle of the rainy season. Sometimes it poured down in such thick sheets of water that earth and sky seemed merged in one gray wetness. It was then uncertain whether the low rumbling of Amadiora's thunder came from above or below. At such times,
in each of the countless thatched huts of Umwofia, children sat around their mother's cooking fire telling stories, or with their father in his obi, warming themselves from a log fire, roasting and eating maize. It was a brief resting period between the exacting and arduous planting season and the equally exacting but light-hearted month of harvests. Ikemefuna had begun to feel like a member of Okonkwo's family. He still thought about his mother and his 3-year-old sister, and he had moments of sadness and depression. But he and Nwoye had become so deeply attached to each other that such moments became less frequent and less poignant. Ikemefuna had an endless stock of folk tales, even those which Nwoye knew already, were told with a new freshness and the local flavor of a different clan. Nwoye remembered this period very vividly till the end of his life. He even remembered how he had laughed when Ikemefuna told him that the proper name for a corn cob with only a few scattered grains was Eze Agadi Nwayi, or the teeth of an old woman. Nwoye's mind had gone immediately to Nwayeke, who lived near the Udala tree. She had about 3 teeth and was always smoking her pipe. Gradually, the rains became lighter and less frequent, and earth and sky once again became separate. The rain fell in thin, slanting showers through sunshine and quiet breeze. Children no longer stayed indoors, but ran about singing, "The rain is falling, the sun is shining, alone, Nadi is cooking and eating." Nwoye always wondered who Nadi was and why he should live all by himself, cooking and eating. In the end, he decided that Nadi must live in that land of Ikemefuna's favorite story, where the ant holds his court in splendor and the sands dance forever.
This ends Disc 1.